You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to episode 35 of The Rex Chapman Show with my super dope homeboy from the L-Town, Josh Hopkins.
From the L-Town. Keep it going. That's nice. Well done.
I know. There are two people who like that bit.
Yeah. That's it. The L-Town. How are I see you're in Brooklyn there. How are things?
Things are good. Can't complain. Pretty
like
day.
A nice day.
A little chilly. Yeah. And also, you don't know this, but your Tatum is here. Your Tatum flew in last night. Your Tatum, my middle daughter, Tatum Ellery
Chapman.
How is
she?
She's great.
She is one of the biggest lovers of cinema that I have ever met. Television, good television as well, but she knows it and loves it.
Yeah, she does. She's here visiting, so I'm happy as I can be.
That's great.
My Tatum's here. What's been up, buddy? You good?
Yeah, man, I've just holding it down. Holding it down. The usual.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a decent day here in Austin.
Beauty.
It's a little cloudy, but
I see you're hydrating, getting your electrolytes in.
Yes. Always. Got it. It's a temple.
That's right.
That's right.
Episode 35.
I've been all over.
It's episode 35, Josh. Famous 35. I go right to Reggie Lewis. Rest in peace. But he was terrific with the Boston Celtics. Who else? Other 35s?
Durant.
Maybe the best 35. He was 35 for quite a while, maybe still. Love me some Kevin Durant.
Was Daryl Griffith 35?
Daryl Griffith is 35, Josh. Thank you.
That's your guy.
And I remembered it. That's why I brought him up. Why wouldn't I bring him up first? Of course I would bring him up first.
These aren't the droids you're looking for. Sure.
The Daryl Griffith episode.
Yeah.
I buried the leash.
Yeah.
Episode 35, man. And speaking of 35, KD, he's back now. Watched him play against the Miami Heat.
There's a lead in there.
We'll get there at some point. But the Nets took it on the chin last night. The Sixers look really well. It looks like Ben Simmons isn't going to get back to play against the Sixers in Brooklyn. It remains to be seen how the Nets season is going to play out. But the Sixers are rolling. And there's apparently a new big three in town with our Kentucky homeboy, Mr. Tyrese Maxey.
Yeah,
he's playing ball, hooping alongside Big Joel and James Harden. What do you think about that so far?
I mean, it's worked out really well for him so far. I love every time you see Maxey play, he just seems just so happy. He's smiling, and I bet he's just a great teammate to have.
Yeah.
And they seem to have really, this city of brotherly love has really taken him in. And that's a tough, if you can win them over, you can win anybody over. And he has, that city loves him.
Yeah. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how this whole East plays out. It's going to be a gauntlet. The best team in the league or in the East right now is the Miami Heat. Did you know that, Josh? I know you're aware because you keep up with our Kentucky homeboys, Bam Adebayo and Tyler Hero. So what I thought we should do is get somebody on this week that could tell us a little bit more about Tyler Hero and Bam Adebayo in the East.
Like who?
Well, we have today another person that's going to make us feel like shit about ourselves after the interview's over, because the person is so together and so worldly and so fun, so curious. We have the assistant coach of the first place Miami Heat, NBA champion, two-time NBA All-Star, longtime pro, my guy, James Caron Butler. What's up?
What's up, brother? How That's the first today? Time my government name been used like that, man. So I got to watch out for the hackers.
How you feeling, man?
Man, I'm blessed, man. You know, just coming off a whirlwind of, you know, great games, and we got great momentum on our side right now. So just great to be talking basketball.
How's Josh and I are both from Kentucky. He's a huge basketball guy, of course. How are our guys Bam and Tyler Hero doing?
They're doing amazing. I think the constant evolution of their this games, and obviously we knew they both was like high character individuals, but just their skill set and the way that they're just, you know, just continuing to, you know, ask for more and more information and receive it and do it like so seamlessly throughout the course of the season is just, it's mind blowing to me. Like, people always talk about our structure here, but the structure only works with, you know, people that's receptive to like constant information. And it's just great to have those young jewels.
I remember, you know, when they were coming through Kentucky, and I was doing the TV radio stuff there at the time. And Keith Askins, who's a part of your organization, my teammate with the Heat way back in the day. Geez. So,
yeah.
And so Keith, he'll come to me about the Kentucky guys. And I remember he came about Bam. And I said, man, K.A., they're talking about him being a second round pick. I said, if I don't know anything else, I think they had like the 13th pick. I said, if I don't know anything else, Bam's going to walk in there at 6'10 with those big hands and the character that he has. And the other thing about the Miami Heat culture that I know is that you got to be conscientious, and you got to be in the time and score and know what offenses and defenses you're in. Bam is conscientious. He never, you know, takes a playoff. And Tyler's much the same way. The great part about him too, and I hope it's your experience with them, you tell them one time and they get it. You know, they understand what you're saying. If you tell them to do it a different way, they know. Has that been your experience?
You know what? I think the love of the game of basketball, you're talking about two individuals that's extremely talented, because you got to have that. Mm-hmm. But then you also have the drive and the passion for your craft. For instance, I can give you an example of something that I always knew that this was in Tyler's makeup. But, you know, just coming off a game like he just had in Milwaukee, I think one of the biggest things for him was getting over the hurdle and seeing the ball go in against his hometown team. You know, like, we both
going back
in
home,
the state of Wisconsin. Yeah. It's a burden. Like, people don't understand, like, when you're from a certain place – you got, you know, 30, 40, 50 fans, and then you got the people that you're connected to that you don't even know you're connected to in the crowd, and just overcoming that barrier. He bust through it last game, you know, and it was just like special to watch, because I know the way that he like dissect the game, and I know that the way that he look at the game. He's such a student, and I knew how bad he wanted it. So for him to perform well and then take that momentum on the back end of a back-to-back and go to Brooklyn and play the way he did last night with the absence of Jimmy and PJ and obviously Kyle out, I just thought like it was just a great step in the right direction for him and his career going forward as one of the leaders, young leaders of this ball club.
Man, as I'm sitting here listening to you, and, you know, we've worked together at NBA TV, and Josh, I told you before Caron came on, this is another episode that should be called Josh and Rex feeling like shit about themselves, because Caron Butler is so together. But as I'm listening, I'm realizing you're going to be a head coach in this league. You want to be a head coach. It's pretty. Absolutely. I mean, you don't waste your time doing something that, you know, you're not devoted to. So man, I'm happy for you. I'm proud of you. Before we talk too much other basketball, I'm going to let Josh get in a question here in a second. But first thing, I want to dive into something completely different. Growing up, how did being comfortable with guns and drugs at such a young age mold your opinion, you know, when you now see, you know, kids who are acting just like you were growing up?
And we should preface it a little bit by saying, you know, people that don't know your story, it's an amazing one. Like you're that dude. It's not like the, you know, the Wire. This is like, oh, I'm tough from, like, you were dealing drugs at 12.
Yeah.
And were apparently were arrested 15 times by the time you were 15. So you've made this leap. Now, with that, with the audience knowing that,
yeah,
let's delve into to this, your past.
Yeah. You know what? Like, the biggest thing for me is, like, for a long time, you know, when I was on the journey of going to prep school, college, obviously eventually the NBA, but I was always, like, hesitant to talk about my past, you know, because I felt like, you know, it was somewhat crippling to revisit that space because it wasn't other stories out there. And I was just like, oh shit, I can't really talk about it. And then the NBA is so buttoned up. It's like, we got dress codes, we got this. So they don't want to, like, hear about, you know, the street life and all my realities. But what I start seeing is that when I start coming back home, you know, first successful as a prep school player, then eventually college, Big East player of the year, all this stuff. And I saw, like, the influence and the impact and the connection that I had with the people in my community and obviously people all over the world, that this is before social media and all that just, like, knew my story, you know, through clips and, you know, newspaper reads and things like that. So I was like, man, you know, it's not a lot of people that's touching on the realities of their life if they've been through a lot of adversity. So why not be that dude? Why not be that person with this platform to do it? And if it turns out well for me, great. You know what I mean? But if it doesn't, I could sleep. I can live with myself because I know I was true to myself. And I identified that early. So I'll never forget. I went on the Jay Leno show and I got traded to the Lakers from Miami. And that's, you know, that's a fun talk show, late night talk with Jay. And I was supposed to be talking about basketball, Jay Leno, all that shit. And Jay was like, hey, man, how was your childhood growing up? And I was just like, oh, shit. Like, hey, listen, like, Rex, like, it was crazy, Josh. Like, nobody ever asked me that. Like, no. You ever see, like, how we greeted each other when we first saw each other? Like, hey, what's up? How you doing? Hey, Mitch. People never ask you how you doing because they just assume you're well. You're making millions of dollars. So I was like, man, my childhood was fucked up. Like, you know, like, I was, it was fucked up. It was bad. Like, it was real bad. Like, I was like, damn, no one ever asked me that. And then I started crying. I started crying on Jay Leno. Yeah. Like, I was dropping tears. Like, yo, this, oh, man, I'm so sad. Oh, man, it's crazy. Like, all the stuff I went through. And the feedback that I got from that moment was this. One, I was as humble as I ever been because I was vulnerable and I let it all out. But the next day, you know, Halle Berry coming to the basketball game and saying, like, I'm a huge fan of a man that can let out his emotions on national television. You know, my brother Kobe Bryant, you know, God rest his soul, coming like, yo, you got to tell your story more. Like, we got to get you in front of people more. Like, you got to let people know, like, what you've been through. And this shit is like, this is like dope to speak your truth to power. And I was just like, man, you know, like, tell God, take the oxygen out of my body. I'm going to do that. I'm always going to pivot back and tell my story because it's people that need to hear it. It needs to be echoed. And, you know, thank God that, you know, I joined forces with Mark Wahlberg and he felt like people need to also see it, you know? So it's like, it's a good feeling, man. And I appreciate you guys allowing me to, you know, just touch that on this platform.
Well, we're honored that you're here and we'll discuss it because I know at this point people know it and you've talked about it a lot, but I want to know, like, how were you recruited to start dealing drugs at 12? Do you remember the moment, the time? Could you have stopped it? Was it something you had to do? What was it? How did that start?
The craziest thing is, like, you know, like, every male in my family had run-ins with law enforcement, and rightfully so. But, you know, we was all leaders in our own right, but we was also easily influenced by the intangibles that came with the game, street life, you know. And I had drug sales going on all up and down my street. From the second I jumped off the porch, that's what I saw. Like, my uncle sold drugs, my cousins, like, every male in my family was some type of hustler. They worked, but they also hustled. So, you know, one time my uncle friend, crazy, his name is Steve, he was just like, yo, like, he had like the leftover shakeup of the drugs that he had bagged up. And he probably came out and gave me like a quarter ounce of hard rock crack cocaine. And he said, you know, this yours, little homie, like, do what you want. And I was just like, damn, that was my introduction to the game. It was like, all right, I see what it is. I know what it is. I see the traffic. I see the movement out here, and I know how to, you know, just, you know, bag it up and just go up to an individual and sell it. So that's how I got involved in, you know, selling drugs at a young age.
Do you remember the first person you approached?
No, I didn't approach them.
They approached me. Yeah.
They just came, like, to you.
Yeah, they were just like, you know, shorty, you holding? And I got what you need. And it was just a quick transaction. I don't forget. Now that street is named after me. It's Karamba Drive.
But wow.
My first drug sale happened on Meade Street, and now it's Karan Butler Drive.
That's amazing. Do you did you get a rush from it at that age? Did you just enjoy the money? Was it something, were you like, I'm gonna stop this in a month? Or what was your thought then?
And Karan, yeah, that's what I was going to say. But also, and was there a sort of a fear that of, you know, getting busted, that was also kind of an adrenaline thing?
You know, I never feared going to jail, because the gain in my mind as a kid, you know, 11, 12 year old kid, it's like the gain is worth the risk. If I'm out here hustling and say I make, you know, $1,500 to $3,000 a day, like, that's worth the risk, because I'm in survival mode. I'm in the hood. My mother's making $7.25, $8 an hour. Like, it's, you know, it's a lot of gains to this lifestyle. I never thought about the consequences of it either, because I was just like, you know how we are. We're so naive and competitive. It's like that won't be me. Like, that shit won't happen to me. Not until, you know, my homies and dudes that I played in the sandbox with start getting killed and murdered on the street, or when they had to, like, man, the dude tried to pull off with my arm in the car and drag me up a block and a half up the street as I was doing a drug sale, things like that, where it's like, oh man, like, it's different. And then you start carrying guns to protect yourself, not even knowing, like, the danger and the consequences that come behind, like, because everything's just happening so fast, you're just like in the moment. So it wasn't until I got unplugged from it, where I had to go to Ethan Allen, you know, sitting in that cell for 18 months, I'm like, damn, I was risking it all. Like, somebody just got shot behind me. One of my friends died in front of me. Like, I'm like, all this stuff. And I wasn't even processing it. I never reflected on it, because I was just in it. I was just like, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm
doing. And you're hooping. And you're hooping.
But I didn't love basketball then.
Right.
I love the game. I love the hustle and the game. I love being in it. But I fell in love with basketball, because basketball was like the perfect segue to get me out the streets. And it still gave me everything I got, the rush, the everything that I got in the game.
When was the moment that you fell in love with basketball? When did that happen?
When I was in Ethan Allen, boys, when I was in Ethan Allen Boys School, another name for the correctional facility, that's when I started playing basketball and I fell in love with it. I found myself working on my game relentlessly. I found myself shoveling the pavement to go outside and, you know, for that 45 minutes to an hour to get my rec. Like, that's when I really fell in love with basketball.
Damn.
Yeah.
You were earning your rec time to go out and work on what your future job was going to be.
Yeah. And it was a guy, it was a correctional officer in the facility by the name of Sir Ping up in Waukesha. He saw that I had it, like I had a gift, and he just started giving me more access to the courts, you know? So he was trying to get me on furlough so I can leave the facility. But because I had a high risk, flight risk or something like that. They wouldn't let me leave the grounds, but he still gave me a lot of access to the basketball courts to work on my craft.
Man, we could talk forever about all this stuff. Also, you mentioned somebody named Halle Berry. I'll have to look that person up later.
He sounds cool. No.
Yeah, he does. He sounds like a great guy. but Mark Wahlberg, and I wanted to be sure and tell you this, because I know you're friends with Mark. You guys are kind of neighbors, I think, out west. And I'm in New York, and I saw him on a show the other day on TV. And then I went to work out, and as I'm coming out, Mark's standing there. He's standing there. I guess he was in New York to film this morning show or something. And I'm walking by, and there's a camera on him. And I walk right by, and I was like, I just saw him. It's wearing the same thing that he had on TV. And he doesn't know me. And I said, Mark, Rex Chapman. He looked at me, and I said, tell my buddy Caron Butler. I said, what's up? And he said, okay. And then it was like, yep, you must be cool. I don't know who you are, but
that's my bro. Yeah, man. We family, brother. You know what it is.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about that. You know, you guys have become friends. You know, what's it mean to look back on your past and your personal story? Tough Juice, my journey from the streets to the NBA, you know. That's your book, but it's going to be a movie now, right?
Yeah.
And talk about your friendship with Mark a little bit and how everything's come about.
It's crazy because the way that I met Mark, it was so organic the way it happened, because I was doing an autograph signing in Los Angeles, and his assistant, and you know how people name drop and they come up and they're like, hey, you know, I work for this person or whatever, especially in LA. You know how that goes. And I'm signing some stuff, and you know, the guy was like, I work for Mark Wahlberg, he wants to meet you. And I was just like, yeah, all right, whatever. Like, I just kind of brushed him off. But then as I was leaving, he circled back and he asked for an autograph. And he just like, this is before FaceTime and all that. He was like, hey, I got Mark on the phone. And we talked. I end up going up to his spot the next day. Like, oh shit, this dude legit. So I end up going to talk to Mark, and you know, we just became friends, started inviting him to games, things like that. And, you know, after that, Kobe had really, like, moved the needle on me doing this book. And, you know, fast forward like a year and a half later, I ended up putting the book out, publishing in it through Lions Press. And I told Mark on the project that I was working on and how long the process was. And I wanted it to be right and detailed. And I didn't want to edit any things out my story, because I wanted to make sure I touched on all the most important things. He said, when you get it done, make sure I get it first. So I was like, you know, I'm not even thinking about business.
Yeah.
We're just friends. Like, we're like 3-4 years into our friendship. I'm like, all right, cool. I'll make sure you get the book. And I made sure he got it. Like, the first 50, 40 copies I put printed, I made sure he got one. And he called me. Now, this is when FaceTime is available. He FaceTimed me, he called me. He's like, oh, We got to make this a movie. And I, you know, I think he's just like hype, because, you know, whatever. He's like, bro, this is a movie. This is a bit like, this is a movie. And I was like, all right, cool. And he was like, hey, let's get a contract done. Then I was like, oh shit. Like, he's for real. Like, oh, okay. Like, I thought he was just hyping his friend up, like, "Yo, you my boy, like, good job." And he was like, "Oh, like, this is a movie, man. Like, this is it." And it, you know, we got it done, and then now we just finally, we had three drafts of a script that was done, and one thing that wasn't right for quite some time in the script and in the draft that didn't sit well with me, because I didn't want it to be like the typical Hollywood movies. So I said, me and Mark agreed, we got someone else to, you know, edit the script a little better. We just got the final draft of the script. We love it. Production loves it. And now, you know, we're moving forward. So everyone's in a good spot now. But it took 6 years for him to make The Fighter. We're at 5.5 years that it's going to take to make Tough Juice. But we comfortable now, and I'm 100% it's going to get done.
That's great, man. I can't wait.
I don't know if you know, Corona. I'm an actor, and I was in The Perfect Storm with Mark, and I'm just so thrilled that you just offered me a role in your movie. That's so cool. That's so great. Yeah, I can't wait. Yep. Mm-hmm. Everybody. Can't go back. Yep.
The Rex Chapman Show is sponsored by Ticket Smarter. Ticket Smarter helps customers from all walks of life experience the power and excitement of live events by giving back through children's charities and creating helpful partnerships. $1 from every transaction will help our charitable partners, including St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, the V Foundation, Quarterback and Children's Health Foundation, and Coach to Cure MD. Ticket Smarter is the official ticket resale partner of PBR, NJCAA, and over 35 collegiate conferences with 250 plus universities, including the Pac-12. While I'm here in Brooklyn, I could catch a Nets game or any of the concerts coming to the Barclays Center. Buying with Ticket Smarter is quick, easy, and 100% guaranteed tickets. Find tickets to more than 125,000 concerts, sports, and theater events. Order now. Let's talk a little hoops, college hoops. What was it about playing in the Northeast that appealed to you with the transfer to Maine Central and then committing to UConn when you could have gone anywhere?
I needed the family structure. Like everyone, you know, I want to be real as I possibly fucking can, like right now, like with this topic and this conversation, because I think if you can be bought, you can be sold. And I think that a lot of universities and, you know, organizations, not to put no one on blast, but they would just come in to like to buy your talents. Everyone coming with a bag. Everybody's offering you these different things.
What?
Yeah, what? It's crazy. That's exactly what it was. Like, hey, man,
I know.
Much? Like, how much? I'm like, damn. Like, my mom named Maddie. Like, she right here. Like, you know, like no one wants to have that type of relationship. And for whatever worth, like that was important to me. Like, life shouldn't be about transactions. It should be about like really getting to know people and what it is and like what's their why and how can you help them get to where they're trying to go. So Calhoun came with a different approach. When he came in there, he talked to my grandmother. He talked to my mom. He talked about what the university had to offer. It was a way, but the family structure of it and how he was going to make it his personal objective to just like really, you know, make me a better version of myself, you know, and these are the things that he felt I needed to get better at, you know, in basketball and also in life. And my grandmother and my mom, like, totally agreed. They were just like, damn, like, that was different. You know, this man coming here, and he came to the neighborhood center. Like, he came to the hood. Like, Calhoun came to the hood. Like, it's pictures of him in the Bray Center, like sitting on courtside, like just chilling, watching everything. And that's at a time where a lot of stuff was going on, and he still made it his business to come in there. But that made me go to UConn. That was like, all right, I'm going to UConn because he's about all the right things. And as I'm about to turn 42 years old next week, he's been true to everything he said he wasn't about. Like, hindsight, like, that was the best possible decision I made in my life, like going to college at the time.
Just basketball-wise, were you surprised at all, because you were great right off. I mean, 2 years, you 15 and then 20 something a game, just right up. Were you surprised at the success you had, or did you know it?
So Rex could, like, I don't know how to compare, make the comparison with acting, but Rex know, like, it's a certain feel that you get when you come into like a locker room and on a court, where you just be like, I don't want to sound arrogant, but he's like, you know, you just be like, yo, I'm the baddest motherfucker here. Like, you know, for real.
Yeah,
it's a feeling. And I like, the second I stepped in there, even though I was a freshman, I was just like, oh, can't nobody fuck with me. I was like, like, in my head, I was just like, nobody could do nothing with me, right? Like, I felt that. And I was just like, all right, I just need a roadmap. I need someone to just show me how to get there. But I know, like, can't nobody do nothing with me. And he helped me figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just a feeling. It was like, damn, this is perfect.
Well, yeah. With acting, just so you know, it's, I walk on the set and I'm like, God damn, I'm beautiful. I'm so good looking. I'm best looking one here.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Oh, shit. Hey, see, coming off a national championship with Rip Hamilton, led by Rip Hamilton, what was the state of the roster when you came in with Khalik Brown and then Mecca Okafor and then Ben Gordon?
Building. Like, it, like, we had high expectations because it was UConn and it was the Big East. But other teams got significantly better. Like, I think St. John's had, like, guys that had a hell of a recruiting class with Omar Cook and guys like that, you know, Ron Artest, like, they had a squad. And then Seton Hall with, you know, Eddie Griffin and guys like that. It was just like, damn, like, we was, like, just in, like, a rebuild mode, but we try to do it on the fly. Instead of rebuilding, we try to just reload and skip that whole process. So we needed, like, high IQ basketball players to come in and perform at a high level. And Khalik Brown had reached out to me. He was like, bro, we can have the best recruiting class if you go with me. He's like, I'm going to UConn, but if you come with me, like, we can do some damage. And then we knew that it was important that we made UConn basketball look fun, you know, because we had other guys on our radar that we wanted to do. So we knew, like, if we can win a championship in 2 years, you know, we missed the 2 year window, but they got it in 3 years. But we thought like that as, you know, guys coming to the university. We was like, man, we about to make this shit fun, and we're going to be a recruit magnet for, like, all these other dudes that we need to add to this roster. But it took a life of its own. And that's why I felt like we was the first domino to fall before, like, the Rudy Gays, the Charlie Venezuela, Andre Drum, yep. All that, like, yeah, because they saw us and it was like, yep. Oh shit, that's dope. You know what I'm saying?
Man.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
you ever been more nervous for a game in your life than before the Big East Tourney championship game against Pitt? And did you ever think that night would go double overtime?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you why I was I had just the butterflies in my stomach, because I was playing against my roommate, Jerron Brown, in prep school.
Wow.
Right?
And I didn't know that.
Yeah, we was roommates for 2 years at MCI. And we talked about everything in the locker rooms, obviously back in our dorm room. I would be like, I'll give him, like, nuances of the game that I was looking for. So I just felt like he kind of knew me better than anybody.
Yeah, right.
And he was guarding me. And, like, honestly, he gave me trouble the first probably 4 or 5 shots I took. I think I was like 1 for 6 or something. And then I got him in foul trouble because I know he loves sticking his hand in the cookie jar. So I got him a few times and he was out for the half. And that's when I went on a tear. But wow. I was nervous because my cousin had just gotten a car accident the day before. She lost her life.
Man.
And I was just like, I was really inspired to go out there and dedicate that championship run in the Big East to her. And but playing in the Garden was just different. You know, then it's different now as players, you know, but that was just like something I always dreamed of doing, stepping on that platform. You know how it is going to MSG. Yep. Like, it's just different.
The best. You'd gotten as far as the Elite Eight, but then opted for the draft first. How hard a decision was that? How was it being able to see your teammates pull off winning the title the next year?
You know, it's crazy because my first year, and this just goes, it's a testament to UConn and Calhoun family structure and dynamic. The first year, I thought I was ready to come out, and I wanted to leave.
Mm.
And I told Calhoun, I'm leaving. He told me I wasn't. So I did. So yeah, I said, Coach, I'm coming out. He was like, no, you're not. I said, shit, okay, cool then.
Yeah.
But then the second year, he was like, all right, you got to go. And I didn't want to go. So that just goes to show you, like,
wow,
the family environment. I was like, damn, I don't want to leave Connecticut, man. It's like everything I always wanted, everything I dreamed of was here. But, you know, they prepared me for, you know, the next step. But it was tough, man. That whole process of, you know, getting ready for the draft and everything, it took a life of its own. But that was a tough process.
You know, I'm thinking back now, because when I left school, you know, I was a sophomore, and then, you know, the guys in my grade, they were still playing junior, senior. Well, Ramil Robinson was a junior at Michigan that year. We were in the McDonald's game and all that. We came up through the ranks, and I remember we were playing the Bulls in Chicago this night that the Final Four was on, and I watched Terry Mills and Ramil Robinson win the national title. Yeah, I watched them win the national title, and I was so And I'm playing for Charlotte, and we're probably 14 and 55 at the time. And, you know, we're terrible. And I'm watching those guys, and I know this is different because they're your teammates. And I know you're happy for them. But I remember watching those guys win that title and being like, damn, if I was at Kentucky, I bet we could have won that title this year. Or, you know, just I was happy for them, but also like, God, I'm envious. How was it for you watching your boys win the title?
I was happy for them because I felt like it was like my DNA was all over that.
Right.
You know, like that's how I really felt. Like I was I put that
also
together.
Gross. Also gross.
I'm telling you, like I was like, yo, I really put that whole thing together, and I was like so like still forming as like a mentor to a lot of those dudes, connecting with them, talking to them. And I ended up going, you know, on the title run and when they won. And obviously that summer I was waiting. Calhoun told me like, what's your address now? And I was chilling. And he sent me the championship ring. Like,
oh, come on.
Oh man.
Yeah. He was just like, you know, thank you. Like you put this together. Like, thank you. Wow. You started this. And that I was like, damn, that's dope.
Oh, that's fantastic. That
gives me goosebumps, man.
Let me ask you real quick, because you've got such a unique perspective with social issues. We'll move on to basketball, but I've read a couple things you've said, because the police reform is big in the culture right now, but prosecutorial reform, and I read where you spoke about lawyers that don't have their clients' best interests in mind in the system and the way it works. Could you talk about that a little bit? Cause it really intrigues me.
Yeah. Well, you know, where we from, we call those, you know, representations, public pretenders. You know, when people are in a position to represent an individual and not bargain with a state. And I think that's just, you know, bad practice. And, you know, those are the things that need to get highlighted. Like in the state of Wisconsin, where the demographic is under 10% Black in that region, we talk about Black and brown people and the way that they're, you know, apprehended every 3 seconds in America is, you know, a stoppage, a police stoppage of a minority in the United States. So, and they can document that, but they can't document it in states like Wisconsin. There's no data for it. So we're trying to figure out like, all right, if that representation is in there, and if that we need to have like a some type of data pool for these bargains that happen, you know, with the people in the Black and brown community with prosecution. You know, you're not doing deals, you know, with the state because you're not shopping and selling people. You're doing the best by your client. And I think that's been overlooked for quite some time. and I've been a product of it. I was shopped. I was sold on the market in the judicial system, and I had to go do 18 months. I felt like it was programs and things that existed that I could have went to, and I see that happening far too often with individuals, and also with the penal system. People aren't going to jail being rehabilitated. I don't think that's the focus. You're locking them away and they're coming off and back into society worse off than ever. Now, why is that a problem for, you know, everyday people? Because if people aren't being rehabilitated and they were bad off when they went in, they're going to be worse when they get out. And that's just something that we have to really look at and, you know, look at other methods to rehabilitate some of these inmates so they're better off coming out than worse.
Well, it means a lot hearing it from you, someone that's been through it, rather than, you know, the talking head on CNN or whatever. So thank you for sharing your story and talking about this stuff, because it means a lot.
Yeah, appreciate it. I get like my mind and my thoughts go everywhere because it's just like, we've been fighting this battle for, I know it's cool as hell to talk about it now because it's the thing and it's trending and everybody talk about it. But just like Juneteenth Day, just like, you know, all these isms that we deal with, I've been talking about this for a majority of my life, you know, since I was a kid, because it was my reality, you know, so it wasn't something I had to go read a book about or read an in-depth article. It was one, something that I experienced. The trauma that a lot of people in my family and loved ones experience. And then it was just like, shit, I want to just bring like a lot of these conversations to light. Like, you do as you please with them, but I want you to know, like, don't ignore this stuff because it's a problem for people for all walks of life, whether you're Black, white, whatever. Like, this is a problem. Like, this is a systemic problem that needs to be addressed in our society. Now, obviously we got all type of other things, but this is just something that, if you was going to allocate your time, just like we like so diverse in investing, like we go here, we go there, we go there. It's like allocate a little energy in this because this is important going forward for our society.
Man, I've just started to talk for 5 minutes. And the thing about it that just shines through is that with most great athletes, great players that become, you know, all-stars and Hall of Famers, they have great imagination and they're very curious. And as you can tell, Josh, Karan's one of the more curious people and conscientious people that you'll ever come across. And I know for you, Karan, over the last couple of years, because of what we've been going through in society, I know you don't want to talk about this shit. I know you don't want to talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. Right. But if it's not talked about, then it's just pushed aside and pushed under the rug. And I can't thank you enough for using your platform. And I know you have to pick your spots. You know, it's tough. It's tough right now, you know. And so I'm so thankful for you talking about everything from prosecutorial stuff to voting rights to women's issues to everything that, you know, people like Josh and I need to pay more attention to and people that look like us need to pay more attention to. So thank you.
Likewise, brother. And, you know, with your amazing platform that you have, man, and Josh, I just got to know you, but, you know, Rex, you've been doing it at an amazing clip for years. Like, for real, you know, you took the whole block in charge and everything, but you also, you have humor, you have laughter on your social sites, but you also educate, you know, from your perspective and your observation and your lens. And I think that's extremely important. That we need, you know, more people like you to continue to use their platforms and do that. So I applaud you for that, brother.
The Rex Chapman Show, powered by Basketball News, is sponsored by Prize Picks. Prize Picks is the easy way to play daily fantasy. It's daily fantasy simplified. It's just you versus the projected numbers, Josh. You can pick from 2 up to 5 players and an over-under on their projected stats for a single game and win up to 10 times on any entry. Prize Picks is safe and offers fast withdrawals, Josh.
I like the sound of this. I like the sound of this.
Well, Prize Picks allows mixed sports entries, offering every sport you can think of. Your Prize Picks entries can be made in 60 seconds or less. It's that easy. You can take the over on Ja Morant's points and the under on Anthony Davis's rebounds if you want. you can receive a match on your deposits up to $100 using our exclusive promo code NEWS. That's promo code NEWS for an instant 100% deposit match on up to $100.
So hold on, program code NEWS, N-E-W-S, like the news on TV?
That's promo code NEWS for an instant 100% deposit match on up to $100. Guess what else? What? Prize Picks has an award-winning, easy-to-use mobile app available in the App Store and Google Play. You spent one season with the Lakers after you, Lamar Odom and Brian Grant were traded for Shaq. In that first season where Kobe didn't have Shaq, how did he solidify that mama mentality?
Bro, it's crazy because that shit happened like 20
years ago. I still can't believe he's
dead.
I still can't believe he's dead.
Yeah, man. It's tough to even think about that. And when you just said that, it's like even tough to like
process it.
But it's every time he stepped out on the court, I've never seen someone more driven. Like just to go out and like just do what he said he was gonna do and like just demolish people, dissect you on the court offensively, show you that you couldn't do anything with him and, you know, be the closest thing to Michael Jordan that we've all seen. Like it was just complete dominance over years. And I was just, you know, I was inspired by like his grind, but more so like his approach to everything. And I think like you can learn a lot from, you know, the mama mentality and Kobe work ethic, but in sports, but you also can, I think the biggest takeaway is just like applying it to your life. Like the way that he attacked things, he was the most prepared for his craft. And if you take those lessons in life, like just imagine what you're capable of doing. Like it's really no ceilings to anything. Like if you apply those things to your craft and to your life, you know what I mean? Like outside of sport.
You know what I found? It would have been interesting to be his teammate and to be around him like that. It reminds me though of, he was a rookie. You know, I was a 10-year player by this time and he was terrible. Like when he came in, he was terrible, wild. Just, you know, you hoped he came in and played for a few minutes. And I'll never forget, I was probably not 8 or 9 years in at this point, but I was as good as I was ever going to be at that point. And so I had my way with him. And 2 years later, within 2 years, he had, you know, just blown past me. Just, he was better. I was like, oh, this guy. But the first time we played against each other, we were playing in the Forum and they had Eddie Jones and they had a good team, Shaq and them. But we were good and we were running them out of the building. And he was in the game third quarter or so. And I'm free throw going on. I'm standing back behind at half court. And, you know, this is in the 90s when, you know, you didn't really commiserate a lot with opponents, you know, it just really wasn't that kind of league yet. But he came up and he stood right next to me and bent down and said, Rex, how much do you shoot during the summer? And I kind of did a double take, like, you know, who is this kid? And what, you know, what? And he was so earnest and honest about it. And a lot of us didn't really dig him yet because we felt like he was just trying to be Michael and he was just trying this Michael thing. And when he asked that, I looked at him and I said, I shoot as much as I can. I said, I jump too high on my jump shot. If I could shoot tippy toe shots, I'd shoot 1,000 a day. I said, but I try to get up 200-300 good quality ones. And then the play resumed and, you know, he was like, thank you. Thank you. But it just tells you how conscientious he was about and what, no matter what you think about him and his game and all that, he worked and it was constantly thinking about it. Right.
Worked his ass off, man.
Yeah.
He really did.
It's so interesting too, you saying, you know, not digging him and not liking him, because one of the not knocks, but a perception of him was, you know, he was silver spoon. You know, he came over, his dad was in the league and spoke Italian. And then, I mean, he just, especially, you know, you come from the real deal hard side, you know, being in jail, coming from that. And then at some point, he just wore everyone down, just like, oh, doesn't nature nurture whatever? This guy is a worker, a killer. He's going to absolutely outwork you. And I just think it's, you know, interesting, nature, nurture, what side of track, whatever. That guy was going to do it no matter what. That was just innate in him, correct? Like, his dad couldn't instill that. He could push it along, but he was born with that, correct?
Yeah, man. I think, you know, the fire that he played with and the fire that he, you know, he had just in life and his creation and creating different things like the books and going off to winning Oscars, like, he just had like a ability to like be great at whatever he committed to. Like, he was committed to the mission. He was committed to, you know, obviously being a better version of himself. And he always talked about that. But I think he's like, really, like, he's obviously is my big brother, a mentor, but he really set the standard for a lot of people across the board. Fuck the favorite basketball player conversation and all that. It's just like, I can literally be here, have like act one go so well, be a Hall of Famer in two jerseys, stay with the same organization, dominate it, exceed all expectations in this space, and then pivot into this space and like, oh shit, I'm already a champion with an Oscar and I'm about to go off and be a New York Times bestselling author and do it again and again. And then now I'm about to create this whole like world of this content. And he was just on that trajectory until that devastating crash. But it's just like, man, like he's the gold standard. Like, in my eyes, like, he's always the guy for me. Like, I'm just like, damn, like,
thanks for sharing.
I'm glad he left that trail, and thanks for this, like, giving me that visual. Like, I'm always thankful for him.
Man. Do you remember where you were when you heard the news? I mean, where were you?
I was in Atlanta. I was calling the game, and
I text you right away.
Yeah, right his away. Assistant hit me, Rita. She had called me and just like, hey, you know, it's true. Like, it's true.
Man. Yeah. Well, all right, let's switch gears. Thanks for sharing it, Karan, for real. I mean, I know it's still hard to talk about. Hey, why do most fans carry the perception that your Mav squad, your championship squad, were sort of the heroes of the league because they denied the Heat the title the first year of LeBron and D-Wade and Chris Bosh?
You know what? I thought we was just a better team. But it's crazy that, you know, Rick Carlisle, when he was coaching, he was like, this is about this is bigger than like just like winning this series and winning a game, winning a championship. This is like all about basketball. It's like basketball being played the right way. You know, the integrity of the game. Like, he made it like, he went like really deep, like some areas where I wasn't even thinking about. I was like,
wow,
like, this is like playing good basketball. We're a better team. We got more depth. They just like superstar power driven. But he was just like, he went like, where are you going with it? Like, this is big. Yeah. You know what I mean? You know, like,
yeah, but you know, in retrospect, you know, they had three Hall of Famers. Y'all had three Hall of Famers.
Yeah, man.
You. Come on now.
We had some depth. Come on. Like,
and J. Kidd is, people don't get it. J. Kidd is no joke. He was no joke.
Sean Marion, Dirk. Like, you know, like, it's,
yeah, maybe one of the more best than
six mans ever.
Maybe more than three Hall of Famers.
Yeah, Jet, like, come on, man. Like, one of the best six-mans ever. Like, people don't talk about that. Like, that team was stacked. But I see – it's crazy you brought that up because I'm looking at our team, right, and I see, like, so many comparisons this season with our squad that we had in Dallas.
Wow.
Yeah, like, the energy, like, the – I'm just like, oh, shit, this is different. Like, I feel like
– here.
But I just don't want to – I don't elaborate on it too much, but I'm just like, I feel some things. Like, it's
– yeah, I don't – well, I'm glad you brought that up. I don't want to put you on the spot too much, but how do you guys stack up in the East? You know, after the one seed, where the Bucks, the Sixers, the Bulls, and the Nets, you know, fit in as we get close to postseason?
Yeah, I mean, the East is going to be – I mean, shit, it's going to be brutal because, you know, a lot of things, a lot of moving pieces still. You saw at the deadline, obviously, with James Harden going where he went. And then, you know, Ben Simmons, who's yet to play yet. But once you get those three guys on the same court, they're going to be a force. You got to give Cleveland and Bickerstaff a ton of credit in what he's been able to create and generate. They're ahead of time. It's wide open, though. It really is. But I really like us. I like where we're at. We're a confident bunch of team, a group, and we just feel like it's time to really just polish and focus on us more so than ever. And we still have some additions that we haven't laid out on the platform yet, which is coming up in the next week with Vic and Markieff Morris. So we're excited about that.
Fantastic. All right, real quick, what's your favorite movie?
Oh, man.
Ever.
Godfather.
Ever. Okay.
Godfather.
Like it. If you could see anyone in concert or speak or whatever, dead or alive, front row center, what is it? Who are you going? Who
are
you
going to
watch? Oh, we. First time we've had it. James Baldwin.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
Fantastic. First time. That's the first time anybody said that. See? Curious. That's what he is, Josh.
That's what he is. I love it. Do you have a favorite, like band or singer or whatever of all time, and dead or alive?
Yeah, I have a few guys. Bob Marley. My wife is Jamaican, so, you know, I listen to the Tones all the time, like, around the house. Bob Marley and probably Sam Cooke.
Wow, that was great. This is soulful. That is soulful right there.
All right, great. So, Karan, I'm going to let you get out of here. I can't thank you enough for taking the time. You're in the middle of the season. We were talking about you before you came on, and I said, Josh, guys, look, you guys are going to – you have an idea of who Karan was as a player, because I did too. I didn't know you. You know, I watched you, and then we worked together, and then I got to know you. And I said, his demeanor, he was not playing around on the court. And he couldn't be the furthest thing from that off the court. He's the nicest guy ever. But then I said, but don't let the smooth taste fool.
He's a real one now.
He's a real one. Yeah, all right, brother. Great. I love you. I love you, man. And keep doing your thing. Stay healthy and go Heat.
Yeah, love you too, brother, man. Thanks again for this opportunity, fam.
Thanks for coming, man. Really appreciate it.
All right, brothers.
Perfect.
Well, Josh, you're right. Happened again. That. Feel like shit about myself.
Right?
What an unbelievable story.
What a great dude.
He's the real deal. I can't wait to be in that movie, too. I mean.
Well, you're going to kill it. You're going to kill it.
I can't wait to read that book for our book club.
Right. Me too. Right. Or not reading.
Yeah.
By the way, and speaking of book club, this week, did you read anything?
Oh yeah. You did? This week, funny enough, I didn't get to anything, but I did plan on it. So yeah.
Okay.
So what about you? Yeah,
I didn't. I was flying a lot this week and naturally sleeping during those times.
Well, you don't have time to read when you're flying. Who has time
when you're sleeping? Who can sleep? Read when they're sleeping.
And sometimes on a plane, you've got this time, but
yeah, I mean, sometimes
it's better to just sit there and be bored. That's important. Right. Yeah.
By the way, we should start to come out with a whole sleep while you read thing. Think about that.
Money to be made there for sure.
That's episode 35, Josh. We'll be back next week with episode 36. Of the Rex Chapman Show with Super Cool Josh Hopkins, powered by basketballnews.com.